Production. Recorded live.
Hey guys, this is Rick. I'm pulling up the questions right now as we speak.
Running a little late, Rick.
I know. I'm definitely running a little late.
Well, it happens. Matt.
Tony, is that you?
No, it's Matt.
Hey, Matt.
And Wendy.
Hey, Wendy.
And Denny.
Go. I was speeding to get here. Let's see, but no tickets. Got it. So, let's see. From the people on the call, let's do something real quick. We haven't done before. So, Wendy?
Yes?
What's your high and low been for the week?
Oh, okay. My high was, I guess my high was last Monday when we had our 911 call, and my husband, who had been a little reluctant in his praise of his wife the week before, spoke up before he shared in the group and said what he felt he should have said the week before. And so that was a big thing for me. And I told him he got big points for doing that and that he probably would need them down the road. But that was my high. That was my high. And I don't know. I can't really think of any lows this week. So that's a first.
That's nice, isn't it?
Very nice.
So, Matt, what about you?
Rick, I really can't go into it right now because I'm at work. We went camping this weekend, the four of us, for a change, first time in 2 years. So, yeah, it's the first time she's felt the need to do anything with the family in over a year and a half.
Good. Now, Dennis, are you here?
Yeah, I'm here.
Did you have a high and low for this week?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess my high was yesterday, and we slept in late, and we had a good time, and that's always high for me. And my low was, you know, I think was last Sunday where we kind of got into it, and I got a little, I was just kind of ranting a little bit. I was just kind of over the top with her, and I was really sorry. I really was sorry for that, and I apologize for it. So those were my highs and lows.
Okay. Let's see. There's two people here that I have not. Who else is online?
It may be Western Washington is us, but for some
reason,
okay. I mean, it's, yeah.
I'm sorry, what's your name?
Wendy and Denny, but then I show up on the thing, too, as Wendy, so I don't know what the deal is there.
Oh, okay.
Western Washington could be me, too, because I'm out here in Puget Sound.
Oh, okay.
Okay, good. Anybody else want to share their high and low then?
That's,
yes?
That's all of us, I think.
Okay. Well, then I will start with the questions. We've got a small group today. That's kind of nice. I think I'll start with one up above here. It makes more sense. I think this one's from Matt. I can't get my unfaithful wife to move out. I'm starting the legal separation process, but this could take some time depending on how hard she fights it. After years of communication with her, I now fully realize she harbors a huge persecution complex. The manager of our store, her best friend, asked me to fix a broken freezer while my wife was out of town. I fixed it, and the only response I got from my wife is that I'm talking to her friend. So now her friend is not talking to my wife. So much for doing good deeds. Rick, while I'm going through the separation process, should I consider moving out? It would accomplish showing her actions are not acceptable, but would put me at a disadvantage in the property claim, as she would have the possession of the house and the children, neither of which, especially the children, I'm willing to give in on. Her actions this past year have damaged our girls, and I do not want them to grow up thinking their mother's behavior is acceptable. While I wait for her to move out or make any decision at all, I will continue the legal process for separation. If her behavior continues down the path, I'm thinking of packing her bags and dropping them off to her. But I cannot legally make her leave. What's your opinion? And obviously, this is just my opinion. Do not put yourself legally at any type of disadvantage, which means you just need to go through the process of separation. It will happen soon enough, sad to say. And so I would just stay with that. And let that get worked out slowly but surely.
Yeah. I see that Diana tagged hers on the bottom, and I've also seen from her post that they've actually agreed to separate, and he's starting the process of moving out, whereas my wife is taking advantage of me. You know, basically, she got a roof to she's got no need to do anything. She's got a roof over her head and a place to crash, but she comes in at, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning and stuff like that, and it's really affecting my youngest, my 10-year-old, the most, who's, you know, starts calling her mom about 9 o'clock every night and stays up and calls her until her mother comes home about every half hour. And like
right.
I said, you know, the other night it was 2:30 in the morning. So.
And reality is, there's nothing you're going to be able. I mean, legally, you don't want to put yourself at any risk because of your children.
Right.
So you just need to follow the legal proceedings, and also don't place yourself at a disadvantage right now.
Right.
I know that if you appear to be non-cooperative, then the problem can be, you know, in terms of a primary conservatorship, the person who's kind of in charge of the kids, that they can make the argument that you're not the best person to kind of manage visitation. So you want to, as you go through the process, certainly keep your own personal boundaries, and but at the same time, don't compromise yourself by moving out.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Let's see. And Diana just put, I feel your pain. I'm in the same boat. My husband won't leave and makes my life very difficult. He is the one involved with someone else, someone who's 23 and he's 44. Our daughter is almost 18. What a mess. I can start the legal proceedings for a legal separation, but unless one of us moves to a different address, the time does not start clicking until we are under different roofs. He comes and goes as he wishes. I thought he would just move out so we could do what he wanted without me asking things or fighting, but he is not. He started the affair in June, and I found out 3 weeks later, but this is not his first affair. This is his fourth. Every single time, it's with someone much younger than him. And this one is very similar to mistress number two. She's a bartender with two kids from different men. Mistress number two was a hostess with two kids but she has both kids with her. The one now only has the youngest child, who is 2.6 years old, and the other child is in her native country in Central America. I just don't know what to do, so I feel for you because it feels stuck. and just says, you have a great day. God bless. So, yeah, get as far as you can. And then at that point, I would just get legal advice from your attorney as you go through the separation. But you'll probably need to get an attorney involved. And, it's just a mess when someone it's almost like wants to take advantage of the relationship, even though they don't want to be in the relationship. And that's pretty sad. So I'm just going to hope and pray that somehow there is a shift. That would be a blessing. Let's see. Dennis, what is the definition of complete brokenness as it applies to the betrayer? How does a betrayer convey the brokenness they feel, even though it may not meet the level of that of the betrayed? Thanks, Dennis. You know, to me, brokenness is best exhibited, I think, by, surrender and powerlessness and unmanageability. When I see somebody that's really broken, they're very humble. To me, humility is two words. It's simply, I can't. People who are really broken have also come to the place where their pride is just completely gone. So you'll hear things when people are very broken, there's no defensiveness, there's acceptance. That was the word I was just trying to think of. There is a tremendous amount of acceptance of who they are as well as what they've done. So they readily take responsibility for their actions. When someone's broken, I think they... In fact, I've got a really good piece on that. Hang on just a second. So, Dennis, for you, how do you see brokenness? How do you define it?
Okay. Let's see. Let's look at it like this. Say you have a junkie who's in an alley, and he's doing up a hot load that he's stolen. Okay, that's completely broken as a human being, as I see it. You know, whereas on the other hand, you have a guy who is on a maintenance program for drugs. He still has a job and he still has a family, but his life is completely unmanageable. Okay, and he comes to the realization that, you know, I don't want to do this. This is not how I want my life to go. And then he starts making changes, you know. He starts doing something about it, you know. So, you know, his broken point is a lot less than the other guy's brokenness point, but still there, he's thrown down the shovel and he started to crawl his way out, whereas the other guy may have already gone too far and he can't get out of the hole. And, you know, that's kind of what I'm... saying is, you know, where's the bottom for one as averse to the other when they can start working their way out of it rather than continuing to live in the sickness that it has been created by this situation.
Right. Let me read this to you. I don't know if this will help or not, but this is something I came across years ago, and it was a comparative analysis between proud people and broken people. It says, proud people focus on the failures of others, while broken people are overwhelmed with the sense of their own spiritual need. Proud people have a critical, fault-finding spirit. Look at everyone else's faults with a microscope, but their own with a telescope. Broken people are compassionate, can forgive much, because they know how much they've already been forgiven. God, people are self-righteous and look down on others. Broken people esteem all others better than themselves. Proud people have an independent, self-sufficient spirit. Broken people have a dependent spirit and recognize their need for others. Proud people have to prove they're right, while broken people are willing to yield their right to be right. Proud people claim rights and have a demanding spirit. Broken people yield their right and have a meek spirit. Proud people are self-protective of their time, their rights, and their reputation, while broken people are self-denying. Proud people desire to be served. Broken people are motivated to serve others. Proud people desire to be a success. Broken people are motivated to be faithful and to make others a success. Proud people desire self-achievement. Broken people desire to promote others. Proud people have a drive to be recognized and appreciated, while broken people have a sense of their own unworthiness, are thrilled that God would use them at all. Proud people are wounded when others are promoted and they're overlooked, while broken people are eager for others to get the credit and rejoice when others are lifted up. Proud people have a subconscious feeling this ministry, church, group is privileged to have me and my gifts. Think of what they can do for God and for everyone else here. While broken people have a hard attitude that says, I don't deserve to have a part in anything. Know that they have nothing to offer. Know that they have nothing to offer God or others except the life of their higher power flowing through their broken lives. Proud people feel confident in how much they know. Broken people are humbled by how much they have to learn. Proud people are self-conscious. Broken people are not concerned with self at all. Proud people keep others at arm's length, while broken people are willing to risk getting close to others and take the risk of loving intimately. Proud people are quick to blame others, while broken people accept personal responsibility and concede where they're wrong in a situation. Proud people are unapproachable or defensive when criticized. Broken people receive criticism with a humble, open spirit. Proud people are concerned with being respectable, with what others think, work to protect their own image and reputation, while broken people are concerned with being real. What matters to them is not what others think, but what God knows, and are willing to die to their own reputation. Proud people find it difficult to share their spiritual needs with others, while broken people are willing to be open and transparent with others as God directs. Proud people want to be sure that no one finds out when they've messed up. Their instinct is to cover up. Once broken, people don't care who knows or who finds out, and are willing to be exposed because they have nothing to lose. Proud people have a hard time saying, I was wrong. Will you please forgive me? Broken people are quick to admit failure and to seek forgiveness when necessary. Proud people tend to deal in generalities when confessing their sin, while broken people acknowledge specifics when confessing theirs. Proud people are concerned about the consequences of their actions, while broken people are grieved over what their actions have cost others. Proud people remorseful over their sin, sorry they got found out or caught, while broken people are truly, genuinely repentant over their actions, as evidenced by the fact that they forsake that behavior. Proud people wait for others to come and ask forgiveness when there's a misunderstanding or conflict in a relationship, while broken people take the initiative to be reconciled when there is misunderstandings or conflict in a relationship. Proud people compare themselves with others and feel worthy of honor. Broken people compare themselves to the holiness of God and feel a desperate need for His mercy. Proud people are blind to their own true heart condition. Broken people walk in the light. Proud people think they don't have anything they should repent of, while broken people realize they need a continual heart attitude of repentance. Proud people don't think they need help, but they're pretty sure everyone else does. Broken people continually sense their need for a fresh encounter with God and a fresh filling of His Spirit. And when I first read that, to me, Dennis, that little comparative analysis probably something more than anything in terms of me seeing the difference between the two. But, you know, how a betrayer conveys that brokenness, you know, all I know to do is just genuinely be grieved over what your actions have cost, you know, your mate. It's not a matter of trying to dance or jump through hoops for the other person. But if someone's truly broken, it really is about a willingness to just be concerned for them. And I think that that brokenness goes a long way to at least just letting, continuing to express concern. So in your situation, how do you typically try to express brokenness in your marriage?
Well, first of all, let me ask you, is that information, is that posted on the website? And I would like a copy of that if I could get it.
Let me see. I'm trying to remember where I got that from. So I've got to be careful just because I want to make sure I give credit where credit's due. But, yeah, I will get that posted on the website so you can get that.
I appreciate it. That would be great. As far as how do I show it, I have a lot of character defects. And when you read down that list, I could say, oh, yeah, okay, I can, I'm that, I can do that. And a lot of them, I said, boy, I don't even come close. I don't even come close to that, you know. So I'm somewhere in the middle. I'm somewhere in between, you know. And expressing complete brokenness is a hard thing for me to do because I don't want to look at the past. I don't want to look at what happened. I want to look towards the future. I know what the past was, and I didn't do well, and I didn't feel good about it, you know. So I want to go forward. I don't want to have to look back. But Wendy needs to go back, and that's
right.
Hard for me to do. And in doing it, sometimes I don't do so well. So because I get agitated and I get frustrated and the character defects then start to really show up. So, you know, having guidelines, I'm a good guideline person, you know, specific guidelines. And then when I'm not doing it, then I can look to the guidelines and say, okay, I screwed up.
You bet.
Yeah. So,
you bet.
You know this, and sometimes it takes me a little while. I'm sorry.
Oh no, I was just saying you're right. I agree.
Okay. And sometimes I get, I get self-absorbed, and it's about me, I know when this happens, but it usually takes me a little while to process it and to come to terms with it and say, okay, you know, I see that and I understand that I was there and that, you know, I did this and I did that and I hurt you and I'm sorry. And I'm sometimes might not be able to convey the sorrow that I feel for what I have done, because you know, I'm ashamed. I'm ashamed of what I did and how I did it, and you know it's not an easy thing to do. So
yeah, you know, one thing about brokenness is being ashamed of what you've done is you know, it's good to have the recognition that you've messed up, but kind of wallowing in that shame makes you 100% totally self-centered.
I've noticed that.
And at some point, you've got to be able to accept grace, if nothing else, God's grace, because until you can understand, really, I mean, the consequence for what I did, Dennis, really was an incredible blessing. I just got more of God's mercy and grace and love. I mean, I'm probably one of the most fortunate people in the world. But until I can accept that really, I've been really blessed because I haven't had to pay for what I've done. The person that ended up carrying all the pain for what I did was, you know, my poor wife. It wasn't me.
I know that.
You know, I just got a lot of love. And when I began to recognize that, it allowed me to be far more supportive of her. So I think that sometimes what gets us in trouble a little bit, I mean, brokenness to me isn't a state of kind of self-flagellation or an incredible state of shame or just kind of beating yourself up or moping. Somebody who's broken, they just see that they are blessed, but at the same time, they're not deluded into thinking that they can do better. I mean, that was the first step, right? I mean, that was their best effort. So
exactly.
What they've learned to do is surrender and just accept what they are and then get on with the business of helping others heal.
And sometimes I can do that, and I do that well, and other times I don't do so well with it.
Yeah, well, those bad mental health days, they really suck, don't they?
That's for sure.
That's for sure. Well, I will try to get this posted, and maybe it'll give you some help in terms of seeing that, okay?
I appreciate it. Thanks, Rick.
Oh, no problem. Okay, here's one. Oh, this is nice. They thanks for answering the question in advance, so you're welcome. Let's see. I am self-employed. In November of last year, my business took a couple of serious hits from the economy. This put my husband and my finances in severe trouble. Around March, we decided to consider bankruptcy. In April, we found out we were having our second baby and were very excited. May 11th, we lost the baby. June 19th, I found out through a third party that my husband was having multiple affairs for the past year, sexual addiction. After confronting him, he relapsed, alcoholic, on his lunch break. He returned to work, inebriated, was fired. So we have a lot we're working on. Bankruptcy, loss of our baby, affairs, sexual addiction, alcoholism, the loss of his job, all in a matter of a couple of months. So here's my question. Having so much going on at once, how does this affect our recovery time for the infidelity? No, P.S., I'm very happy we found the ARC. We've been using it daily for around 2 months now. Thank you for this program. We're also getting counseling from our priest and seeing a marriage counselor. You know, in terms of multiple things, that I don't know that it's the additional things that affect the timeline so much as there's some things that will make it, I say that, there's a lot of stuff there. You know, the bottom line is you've got a lot to grieve. I mean, you've got so many losses. The loss of the baby, the betrayal that's occurred, the financial instability, and the grief is grief. I mean, you're going to have to grieve. I would think that in some ways it doesn't necessarily change the timeline, though, from the infidelity, but it does depend a lot on, you don't control what your husband does. If your husband, as Dennis and I were just talking about, is broken and is working his program, I think that you're probably, the two of you probably have a, because of everything that's happened, an opportunity to probably connect maybe in a more significant way. If, on the other hand, he's not doing well because of all of the other areas in your life that are undone, I do think that might seriously affect the timeline. Because in order for you to grieve, at one level, you need, I think, an environment of safety. You need some stability, of which you have none or very little, just because of the financial things and then his own addictive issues. So if he's doing well, I would say the timeline for the infidelity is probably going to be about the same. I mean, the hard thing is there's just a lot of pain that you're having to walk through. But the pain from multiple things, I think, and the pain from a single thing, I mean, you probably will go through it as an individual, the multiple losses, at about the same speed that you would have gone through just one of those things. At least in my experience, it's just that you've got to have a point of stability, an anchor kind of to work from. I mean, it's really good that you're working with your priest and that you've got a marriage counselor to help the two of you in terms of just being able to communicate and process through these things. But the most important thing really is going to be, you know, him working his program. And if he does that, the other incidences, some of those will actually have a tendency, if you're working well together, I think, to probably enhance your relationship. You'll feel more connected to each other because there's a common enemy, and it's certainly, you know, y'all, and it's not, you know, it's an addiction, it's bankruptcy, it's, you know, a lot of other things. So hopefully that'll help. So don't be discouraged on the timeline. I just pray that he's doing his program. So here's one. Rick, Marie Lynn posted this. My heart breaks for her. What are your thoughts on this alcohol thing and her reaching out to him, waiting for him to pursue her? Read below. I feel alone in the dark, not knowing which way to go. When I first was told about the affair, I thought I could sense his direction. That brought such faith and comfort. Now, all I sense is pain. I know that he's still there, but I can't seem to reach him, God. I feel very up and down. Sometimes I want to text my husband and tell him I love him. I really think I do and can't imagine life without him. September 1st will be our anniversary. Throughout the years, I've always looked ahead to this time and imagined something wonderful. In my wildest dreams, I never imagined this. Because of this drinking and anger, he could be worse. He was last year. When we talked after I found out, he asked me to be patient. He said he didn't need beer, and we talked about not being alone. Have a few with us, at the most six, which I think is a lot. But he was not. But he has not done that. Every week, at least once, he would drink a lot, maybe once more, 6 or so. This is hard to deal with. We all walk on eggshells. My therapist told me that there should be no drinking allowed in our home. It's not healthy for us. I so desperately want him to stop, but I do not believe he wants to. I don't know if I should just not call, because that's what a lot of books say on drinking. He's sensitive and he's a mess. I don't know if he can take the silence. He may feel too rejected, but he can be very mean and probably doesn't want to try anymore. I wish I could have been, there could have been a better way before. This past year or so, I've given everything I could and then some. My youngest daughter says she's glad Dad doesn't call She does not want to talk to him. She is harder to reach, so silent. My oldest is tired of talking about it and is throwing herself into things and people. I'm concerned for both of them. I'm trying to be strong, but they have seen me cry often. My oldest thinks I have low self-esteem and I shouldn't want him back. Even if we don't get back together, I want him to be healed, but I really would like our family together. In summation, Samuel says, what do you think she should do as for the alcohol and reaching out to him, pursuing him, or letting him lie right now? You know, for those of you who aren't familiar with recovery work from addictions, the bottom line is, what do we say, that one is too many for the alcoholic and 20 is not enough. And it's not an issue with an addict or an alcoholic about whether they can control it at three drinks or two drinks. The fact that they have one drink typically means that they can have 20 drinks. So it's a bigger issue. It's not just they would all wish they could control it. All of us do. But the fact is, and what unmanageability is about, is we don't. It ultimately controls us, and we are powerless over it. So my thought, you know, I would agree with her therapist that, you know, probably there needs to be boundaries set. No drinking in the home. He needs to make his decision. Ultimately, he's going to have to hit bottom, I would say. I think the silence you know, obviously I always say pray first, but to me you can't manage his recovery by continuing to prop him up. Ultimately, my biggest concern is that will cause him to, it almost enables him, to keeps him from going to where he needs to go in his recovery. He's got to make the decision. I know I'm kind of stuttering around. This is a tough one. You know, Lynn, this is bad. But that's what alcoholism does. And he's got to address that. Your girls, that's scary. They need to be involved probably in Al-Anon or Alateen. I don't know their ages here. It would be really good, if you're not already, to get involved in Al-Anon. I think that would really help you. And, I mean, you've kind of got two situations going. You've got the betrayal created by the alcohol, and you've got the betrayal created by the affair. I really do look in some ways at the drug addiction or the alcoholism as its own sort of affair. It's an amazing betrayal. I really think that addictions as a whole are nothing more than our needs for love and our need to be loved and to give love, to grow source to the source of love. Those basic needs for love in an addiction actually get attached to a substance or a behavior or maybe a person, not the God-intended person, but someone else. And in that sense, that substance or behavior really kind of becomes their God to some extent. It's what they look to for their own peace and comfort. And as long as they stay on that path, there is no peace for them. And as long as you're attached to someone who's on that path, as painful as it is, you know, it's going to be very difficult. So, by any, I don't, Lynn, by any chance, are you on the call today?
Rick, I don't know if she was able to get on the call. I sent her a note on the forums telling her that I was going to post it, and I don't know if she's here, but I tried to tell her to listen, you know, because you tape it as well.
Okay. Well, she can always go back and listen to it. Did I cover the majority of the stuff, Samuel, that you were kind of, is there anything I missed on that, do you think?
No, you know, the struggle is so typical in that it's the tough love factor. Do you draw a line in the sand or do you reach out to him? You know, my thoughts were, look, you got to do what you feel like the Lord wants you to do, because only he knows the secrets of men and women's hearts, and he may ask you to do something that some people may disagree with, but it might be the very thing that you need to do. So I just kind of tried to encourage her with that, you know.
Yeah, those are such bad situations, and it's really hard. Just addictions as a whole. I hate that she's going through that.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
I hate that all of you are going through this stuff, you know. So, since we didn't have quite as many questions today, does anybody have any topic they want to talk about?
Hey, Rick, this is Matt.
Hey, Matt.
I just wanted to ask Samuel how he's recovering from his surgery.
Hey, thanks, man. I'm doing great. Finger is attached. I am typing away. Just 3 or 4 days ago, I was able to type full speed, man. So thanks for the prayers, and thanks for asking.
You're welcome.
Yeah, we're glad to get his finger reattached.
Oh, see, here we go.
That's a good thing.
See, this
I'm
is
assuming
what's...
there's a private joke in there somewhere.
Yes, this is a public domain, so Rick has to be nice to me as opposed to private moments where he speaks more freely.
What about other topics?
Well, for myself, I think you pretty much answered it for me today, because I mean the main thing that's on my mind is the separation and where I'm going from here and what I'm doing to protect myself, and you answered all that for me earlier, and I appreciate that.
Good.
I guess I have this is Wendy.
Okay.
Kind of a follow-up on the brokenness issue. I think that one of the problems is in, because you talk about grieving for what the other person has lost, and that was one of our little points of discussion and disagreement and pain, I guess, last week when we were talking, was that, you know, he doesn't want to have to, he was very blunt. He said, I would rather that you have to feel the pain and me not have to feel it, you know. And so I don't think there's a lot of grieving that goes on, because I don't think that he's reached that level where, you know, he's truly lost everything. I'm in a position which is kind of freeing in one way, because I lost everything. You know, I don't really have anything more to lose, so I don't have that fear of losing him or the relationship, or because that's gone. You know, that relationship and the person I knew are gone. So I can't fear that anymore, because that's already happened. So I don't know if he is not allowing himself to grieve, or, I mean, if you can't grieve while you're still going through the fear thing of afraid that the person might leave the relationship. So the, you know, the grieving thing is, I think, you know, you can have a person, as I think I'm seeing, you know, someone who is afraid to grieve because it's going to hurt.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are afraid to grieve, are they not?
I certainly didn't want to.
I just
but
don't
it's the
know
only
that,
way through.
Right. You know, I just don't know that there's any other way around it. Kind of like it just, it is what it is. Grieving is grieving. It's what we do. Sad to say. But we have to do. If we're going to survive.
Rick, if I could throw a little caveat in there.
Yeah.
I think my wife would say to me that she didn't think I was truly broken. Obviously, I'm the unfaithful spouse. I don't think my wife thought I was truly broken until I began to grieve what I had done, both to her, but so many of the people that were involved. And I think, I know the piece that you read on brokenness was fantastic. I was in and out of conference calls, but it was awesome. But for me, I can say, I know that if my wife, and even some close, well, the two close friends that are still around, I don't think they thought I was truly broken until they saw me and heard me grieve for what I had done to my wife and to the other people that were involved.
Yeah. You know, it's funny about grief, guys. I think a lot of times we think that grief is a maybe a dark hole. I don't know why we fear it. I mean, it is painful. But on the other hand, I've always experienced grief a little bit like surf, that, you know, it comes in waves. But there's something kind of, there's kind of life on the other side of it also. And, you know, I just, when my mom died, I was really scared of the pain. But I did find it was more like surf, like, you know, the grief would come, it would roll over me. And then on the other side, I was okay. In fact, the sky was blue and the sun was bright and I appreciated life. And yeah, there were different waves, but I think we need to be able to step in and embrace that. And just, it's a part of life. It's not that the painful side of life is any worse or any better than the other side of life. It's just a part of life. And if we can get over maybe our judgment that grief is bad and embrace it, I think there's a great deal of healing that comes from walking through it and acceptance. And it's almost like I can integrate through grief the negative parts of life, and it's where my greatest lessons come. So, you know, it's kind of like, how do we keep from, you know, avoiding it? Because if we avoid it, I really do think it kind of comes out in very negative ways over time, which you obviously don't want to go through. So, I don't know, Wendy, I appreciate your comments on all of that.
I think sometimes he feels that I want him to have to feel the pain because I'm feeling it. And that isn't true. You know, I don't want that for him. I don't wish that for him. All I want, I guess, out of him is somebody to just be with me, you know, emotionally and physically, just be with me, not fix it and make it better, just be with me.
And you know what? That's probably not unreasonable, is it?
No, I don't think
so. No, it is not.
Just a little bit scary.
Yes, this is Danny. It's like in my disclosure of everything that took me over, you know, 2 years to disclose everything, it's like with my grief, I'm really controlling, and I only can let it out a little bit of a time. It's kind of akin it to that, because I don't want to feel the pain, and I know it's really selfish and self-absorbed that I want her to feel the pain, but she's already in the pain.
<You bad>. He's very bad.
Yeah, well,
and I think the pain's going to kill me.
Makes sense. But not quite.
Okay, I'll be quiet.
You know, Rick, that one thing Wendy said about she just wants him to listen and not try to fix things. That's probably the hardest thing for us guys to do, is we're fixers. You know, that's what we do.
Right.
And that's one of my wife's biggest complaints about me. That's one of the things she's using as an excuse for her affair, is that I'm so controlling because I'm always trying to fix things. Well, I'm not controlling. It's just that as soon as she tells me a problem, my mind goes into high gear on how to fix that problem.
Right.
And I've just never learned how to hold that back.
Yeah, and I think that all we really have to do is be, as she said, just listen and be there with them. And my wife, one of her big love languages is quality attention, kind of attunement. If I'll just sit there and just be still and listen and connect, you know, that's important to her. So I think that has a lot to do with it. It's just a willingness out of love to experience with another person, especially if we're the ones who caused a lot of the pain. It's probably good to be able to listen to it. And with that, we'll wrap up the day. I'm sorry, guys, I was a little late starting today, but it's been great having you all online. Be sure, if you're on the forums or anything, remind people that they can actually post questions here. It would be very much, you know, I want people to take advantage of just having this time where we can talk about things like brokenness. So I'll try to see if I can get that thing posted, and hope you guys have a great week.
Why would we do that when we get personal attention?
That's a good point. I don't know why you would do that. That's crazy on my part. I'll see y'all later. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.